Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels. This is Jack.
And I'm Amy. In season one, we explored Sarah J. Maas's A Court of Thorns and Roses. In our post-season content, we look forward to sharing listener feedback and thoughts we received over the last 8 weeks, as well as interview content from some special guests.
The views expressed by the hosts and guests are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author. This podcast is a discussion shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series spoilers may be discussed with or without warning. Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, and depression, will recur throughout the podcast. Listener discretion is advised. This week's guest is Hannah, my sister-in-law. Like Jack and I, Hannah is a creative type who uses creative outlets to explore and overcome anxiety and depression. She has a YouTube channel where she talks about how tools like journaling, art, and prescription medications have impacted her mental health journey. I've always admired how self-aware Hannah is, how her past trauma impacts her choices and reactions to experiences, and I am really excited to hear about her thoughts and experiences reading A Court of Thorns and Roses, since a lot of the themes we discuss overlap with her focus on creative platforms. Welcome, Hannah.
Welcome, Hannah.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here with us. We're so excited.
I'm excited.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. You've been one of our very early fans and one of our number one listeners.
Really? Oh, wow. I'm honored.
It's been very entertaining for me to get your video messages as you've both read the series, which I often like to share with others, and then your messages as you've listened to the podcast. And I think you're going to have a lot of great insights to share with us today.
I sure hope so. I listened to the last episode, I think it was with Nicole, and I was like, oh, shoot, like, it's hard to follow this, because I was like, I have to think of some good answers. So I'm excited, though. I hope I can add some things.
Of course. So, I mean, you didn't start listening to the book until we started recording the podcast and putting episodes out. And I loved getting all of your insights, like through Amy, just like your initial reaction. So you went through all of them pretty quickly. Can you tell us about like just your first initial impressions of the series?
To be honest, my first impression of ACOTAR was really negative. I was like, I don't even know if I want to keep reading, just because I was like, okay, there's Beauty and the Beast. I'm seeing a lot of Hunger Games references, like Twilight. I was like, this just kind of feels like a mashup and I don't feel like it's very original. And then like, you know, at the Under the Mountain with the riddle where as soon as I read the riddle, I'm like, the answer is love. Like, this is so, like, I was like, it's so, I was just like, oh, that's so cheesy. And so I initially struggled to understand the hype, but I was like, I'm just going to keep going because I've come this far and I've heard like it gets better. And then once I read A Court of Mist and Fury, I was hooked. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever. And it's the first time I've like read fantasy and like a series in years, like since I was in middle school. So it was just good to like kind of dip my toes back into it too.
I've heard that from a lot of people on TikTok and probably among our viewership that this series is what really got them back into reading. And I find that really interesting that this is what does it for people. Why do you think that is for you?
I think it's the first time in a long time where I've like really grown to love characters. Previous to reading this, I was mostly just like rom-coms and like thrillers. And it's very like short and sweet. But this was the first time where I was like, wow, I can really relate to these characters, especially Feyre, just like with all the trauma she experienced and how that affects her in future books. It was just actually realistic. It wasn't like she went through all this traumatic stuff and then she's like, okay, cool, like I'm fine, what's next? Which I feel like you see in a lot of other fantasy series where they're like, I'm just prepared to do all this stuff because I'm different, right? But she is so human in that way. Even when she becomes a fae, she still has that trauma, you know, and she still reacts to it in a human way.
You're absolutely spot on with that. I mean, like even with ACOTAR in the very beginning, we meet Feyre and she's had years of trauma and she acts like it. And I don't mean that in the bad way, but just more of a realistic way where she's 19, She's had a rough life. She's been through it. She is cynical and it makes her real.
As you were saying, Feyre comes into this novel with a lot of trauma, and that undoubtedly impacts her relationship with Tamrin. Tamrin? Tamlin. Wow. What was your first impression of their relationship, knowing that she's going into it with this trauma?
I think my initial reaction and the reason why I liked Tamlin so much was that he was offering her protection. Maybe not like emotional protection, but it was the first place where she was really able to rest and not have to worry about anybody else. And I think that's why the red flags weren't clear to me at first, which was kind of concerning looking back when I was listening to the podcast. I was like, oh my goodness, there are so many red flags that I just did not see because I was focused on, wow, Feyre's getting to rest and her family's taken care of. And so I was initially like, this is great. Like, her relationship is great. And I think it's just, I really connected to her because when you've experienced a lot of childhood trauma, even as an adult, you try to find places to heal, safe places. And so you learn how to settle just in order to feel safe.
When I was thinking about interviewing you for this podcast and talking about Feyre, I feel like she has, even though she's the youngest of her sisters, she has eldest child trauma. Mm-hmm. You and yes. I have connected over the years about that. And I totally get it, that I think I was more aware of the red flags because I already knew a little bit about A Court of Mist and Fury going into this novel. So I was looking for it. But I think I also would have looked over it because that idea of peace and safety is very rare and is really necessary for a lot of people.
And in all fairness, like, the red flags are super subtle. You know, he's not locking her up in book one. That's kind of where it always like eases in to that type of unhealthy relationship. And, you know, in many ways, Feyre and Tamlin just did not stand a chance. Like, they were always an uneven playing field there. If you think about it, like, Feyre and Rhysand started as prisoners together. And so they were equals when they started their dynamic with one another. Tamlin always had the power over Feyre, and that was going to always set up an unhealthy dynamic between the two. But he did provide her safety. And we all, you know, that's just like that. We all want that. We're humans. We want that safety. And then if you're a human with trauma, it's extra, extra tempting.
On some level, Tamlin had his own trauma, but the trauma was different and the results looked different for both of them, which I think leads to their disconnect in the end.
You know, that's a really good point. The way they're dealing with their trauma is very typical trauma responses, but they're very different. Like, you see Tamlin getting really angry, right? These outbursts of anger, that is a typical trauma response, or wanting to maintain some kind of control in their life because so much has been out of control. And so maybe for him, it's controlling other people because he's felt out of control in so many other areas of his life. That's a really good point.
Like Amy said, like, they both are dealing with their own trauma, different types of ways, different experiences, and they're going into this like romantic relationship. How would you categorize that type of relationship?
I think, you know, looking back, hindsight is 2020. I would say it was pretty emotionally abusive. And I actually looked up the cycle of abuse. For those of you listening, I am studying to be a therapist. So all this stuff is very interesting to me, just the relational dynamic. So the cycle of abuse is typically you see tensions building, then there's an incident, and then after the incident, you have reconciliation and then a calm before the tensions start building again. And this cycle just continues to repeat, and it can vary in intensity. And you see this with Tamlin and Feyre, except their reconciliation, they never really talk about things. It's more like they have sex and then things are calm again. But then tensions start building because Feyre is being denied so much information and really the ability to make her own choices that. And what I'm thinking of when I say that is like when she thought she was sneaking out, but really there was just the glamour hiding everyone else, right? So she's not acting with all the information, and that kind of builds this tension, which leads up to all these incidents you see with them.
It's crazy because like you see, like as you're describing, I think that's what I immediately identify with Mist and Fury, but you're right. Like that cycle begins in ACOTAR.
Mm-hmm. And I think you see Tamlin taking advantage of Feyre's need for safety and connection. And Feyre mistakes the illusion of freedom for love, because really it's the first time she's ever been free. She doesn't have to worry about taking care of her family. She doesn't have to hunt, and mm-hmm. she can just paint her heart away. That illusion of freedom makes her feel like she's loved, because she really didn't get that from her family.
I love that perspective. The illusion of freedom makes her think it's love.
I don't know if she knows what real love looks like, which is another reason she's more predisposed to be in a end up in an abusive relationship, because she's just repeating family patterns, right? Like, her family used her for her ability to hunt and keep them fed. And so even though it looks different, she's in love with someone who's using her. Well, you know, quote unquote, in love with someone.
I mean, and she recognizes that in A Court of Mist and Fury, that he uses her, and once he gets what he needs, he doesn't give her what she needs anymore.
Right. It's very one-sided.
So maybe straying away from Feyre and Tamlin, what do you feel is the most interesting dynamic in the book for you? And that's okay if it is Feyre and Tamlin. I feel like there's a lot of individuals in this book who have experienced trauma and are just coming together into this melting pot. And so I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
I mean, initially, the most interesting dynamic for me was Lucien and Tamlin, seeing how they interacted, because you're kind of seeing the patterns you see with Feyre and Tamlin on a smaller, like maybe not a smaller level, but on a different level, because they're friends and not lovers. But you see how Lucien is like being so permissive to whatever Tamlin wants, even if he doesn't agree with it, which shows like the extent of Tamlin's power over other people and the loyalty he expects from people around him. Like, he just expects people to do as he says, keep their mouth shut if they disagree. And so really just seeing Tamlin interact with people was interesting looking back, just because now I understand, like, yeah, he had some unhealthy patterns here.
People on TikTok love Lucien, and there's a lot of talk about like how Lucien is in book one versus book two. And this is a little spoiler into the second season for us, but you know, you're talking about the dynamic between Lucien and Tamlin, and people on TikTok say like, oh, what happened? Did Sarah JMS like just forget to write him with his personality, because it all disappears? Mm-hmm. And Amy and I were talking about it, and it, for us, it felt like, well, Tamlin, his powers were restricted in book one. So maybe Lucien had a little bit more, I don't know, like he felt like he had a little bit more leeway with being able to sass him versus book two. His personality does change because the power dynamic has changed.
Lucien, I feel like when he does kind of seem like he doesn't have a personality, but when you're in a relationship with someone who uses you so much, I feel like you really start to kind of lose who you are. You just become this person who like does what they say to try to keep the peace. And he's tried to speak up in the past, and that hasn't gone well for him. So I wonder if he's just doing what he needs to do to survive.
Because we see that in Feyre herself, and we talk about that in the podcast, how she starts to adopt some of Tamlin's persona. And we see that in A Court of Mist and Fury, that she just is permissive and steps back to allow Tamlin to do what he wants. And, you know, something you said about control and how Tamlin is trying to grapple with his trauma by controlling things. We see that from day one when he tells her what to eat and when to stop eating. Mm-hmm. And obviously we don't see Tamlin telling Lucien what to eat, but there are different levels of control there as well.
Well, and I wonder if because Lucien and Tamlin's relationship goes farther back and is kind of different in nature, there's different things that maybe Tamlin controls over Lucien that aren't food. Which I think that's what we've seen. But with Feyre, I wonder if he's just trying to assert himself. Like, he's coming off really strong, because this is the first time, like, someone who doesn't really know who he is coming in.
Yeah.
And so he's just like, here I am, I'm in control, and almost asserting these traits that he wants to come across as, like, I'm strong, I'm powerful, when really he doesn't feel that way.
Food is a huge theme for us. We talk a lot about like food is power, but there's a lot of other themes involved too, like painting and the feminine, and then smashed doors, and then Feyre as the doe. Was there any particular theme that stuck out to you? Or maybe there's one that we didn't even think of.
My favorite one that you guys talked about was food is power, just because I hadn't really considered it. Like, and you see in future books in this series how that continues to be a theme. And like, what I thought of was the house. I think that's in A Court of Silver Flames.
Oh, yeah, with Nesta.
Big spoiler. Yeah, with Nesta. She creates this relationship and she's given food freely by the house. Do you know what I mean? And so it's like she has this kind of relationship where what she wants matters, and they have this connection where they can joke with each other. And so I think that was a theme that I hadn't really considered before. I just hadn't thought of. But once you mentioned it, I noticed it a lot more. And it's very telling of the dynamic between different characters.
I think it could carry on to a lot of other books, too. So if people, you know, continue to read fantasy or anything else and you start to notice food, like it is such an innate method of control, I guess you can say, where people, you know, if you want to control someone, you're going to control what they eat and how they eat and when they eat and where they eat.
Yeah.
And it's so natural for the Archon sisters to be controlled by food, or for power to be exhibited over them through the use of food, because they've been hungry. And so it would almost be odd for Sarah J. Maas to not use food as a control mechanism for them when they've spent so many years starving.
Something that you mentioned there, Amy, of like how important it is for food is power and controlling that with the Archon sisters. How much of Farrah was controlling their food? And I'm not saying that Farrah was withholding food from them, but again, Farrah was the source of food for that family. The sisters had to wait on Farrah to bring back the food. I don't think Farrah was withholding from them, but again, that natural power dynamic is immediately there, because she went from being the source of food and power from her family to Tamlin being that source of food and power.
I absolutely believe it is. You think about, I think in chapter 2, after she brings the dough home, she allows them seconds, which she normally wouldn't do. And then she tells them no more. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to save this for next week or whatever the case is. So I think you're right. I think there's that natural.
That mirrored pretty quickly. We didn't even catch that one. Like, Farrah controlled how much her sisters can eat. And then just like a few chapters later, Tamlin's controlling how much she can eat.
That must have been really hard for Farrah to go from a position where she could control this one thing for her that was traumatic. It's traumatic to be suffering with food insecurity, to all of a sudden not having to suffer like without food, but still having that sense of insecurity, but it being controlled by somebody else who maybe doesn't have your best interest in mind.
So along those lines, as Jacqueline was saying, this beginning moment with Farrah and her sisters, and then the first time Tamlin feeds Farrah, this is one parallel that we see in the book that we actually didn't talk about in the podcast. Are there other parallels you saw, Hannah, or mirrors, as we call them, that maybe you saw that we didn't see? Or were there ones that we pointed out in the podcast that you didn't realize that you found particularly interesting?
Okay, I had this epiphany earlier. It like dawned on me. I don't remember if you guys talked about it, but I was thinking about how when Farrah first sees Rhysand, there's like music playing at, what's it called? The festival thing?
Oh, Calumni? Sexy yeah. Fairy Night?
Yes, that. There's music playing. And then also she reconnects with Rhys under the mountain with music.
Oh.
And so I was just thinking that's really interesting how there's music in both of those and how much that means to Nesta. It almost felt like an homage like to her family and to how she was raised, but also to her connection to Rhysand.
Yes. I mean, her family is a very creative, art-driven family.
That's an interesting point, because it's also music that he sends her when she's breaking down, and she doesn't realize that till book 2. And that's a really important turning point in their relationship. Like we've discussed in the podcast, Farrah is seduced by her senses, and the ties of music and Rhysand, I think, is an important one for her.
And to play more into the like their connection for art and her love for that, if you remember the first time Farrah was looking through the art galleries in Tamlin's manor, he said something along the lines of like, I don't have a use for this. Like, art wasn't really his thing, but clearly that was important to Farrah, and any medium of art can inspire a creative type and they can show an appreciation for it. So automatically it's like, oh, look at that. They're connecting in a way that her and Tamlin never did also.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of like Tamlin with his gallery, it just made me think about how he didn't really appreciate it. And so even with her paintings that she creates when she's there, she has this initial hesitancy to show him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like his not appreciating the paintings that he had that were so beautiful, it makes it hard for her to believe that he can actually appreciate her. But Rhysand, you see with this, you know, connection through the senses, he cares about her and what she likes. And I feel like he's supporting her from the very beginning.
Yes. I always got like the with Tamlin and Farrah and her painting for him, it always gave me like art on the refrigerator vibes. Like, look what I did. I painted something for you, versus like with Rhysand, she has like her own gallery and studio.
Right.
Which speaks a lot to their dynamics, right? That Tamlin treats her the way a parent treats a child,
mm-hmm.
while Rhysand encourages her to pursue the things that she wants to pursue.
We love him.
I mean, he's not perfect.
Wait till book two, Hannah. Pod season two.
Oh, no, you're going to rip him apart.
We're just doing a literary critical analysis is all we're doing.
I'm going to look back and be like, how did I not see this?
We're not saying he's a bad guy. We're just there's just some.
He's a flawed character, and that's OK. He's human, but he's, you know.
He's a bean.
And I think that's the beauty about Sarah J. Maas's writing. All of her characters are flawed. Nobody is perfect.
I really like this, like, perfect Rhysand I have in my head.
But I think this is why we connect with the characters, right? Like you were saying, you enjoyed it because you connected with the characters, because we as humans are flawed and they are flawed as well. And so there's more realism and more ability to empathize than if you had a perfect character who could do no wrong.
Dare I say that in book one, Tamlin is clearly flawed, right? But his flaws aren't obvious sometimes. Like, that's why we miss the red flags. That's why it hurt so much in Mist and Fury when he became the way he was, right? Or showed his true colors, let's say. Versus Rhysand, as I've been doing like the analysis, and again, Amy and I, like, we try not to review notes until the end, but I'd say that Rhysand is sometimes more obvious with his flaws. I know he, like, quote unquote, tries to, like, hide them more, but I find his flaws to be more obvious, which makes him, I don't want to say more perfect, but, like, more forgivable, because he doesn't necessarily try to hide his own trauma the way that Tamlin does.
There's, like, an honesty to it.
Exactly. So while, you know, we're going to be analyzing that very deeply in book two, I don't think the love will go away just because he owns it a little bit more than Tamlin does.
Is Tamlin blonde, by the way? He's blonde, right?
Yeah. That's the first mortal flaw.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the first flaw that I was like,
Unless it's a Draco Malfoy fan fiction, I don't trust.
See, that's different. But blondes, anything else, I'm like,
Or Throne of Glass, actually. In the podcast, we talk a lot about Farrah having to convince herself that she loves Tamlin even more so as the trials go on. What do you think about their dedication to one another by the end of the book specifically?
Well, I was just really expecting, I feel like the whole time they were under the mountain, I was like, Tamlin has some kind of plan. There's a reason why he's not doing something. Like, he must have something in the works. And then he just didn't. And I think it just shows that Feyre is super committed to him. Like, the whole time she was like, I would die for Tamlin. I'll do anything. And this loyalty is something that we saw from her with her family and how she kept her promise to her mom, even after her mom had died. And even after Tamlin was taking care of her family, that was so hard for her to let go of. Whereas I think Tamlin loves the idea of Feyre. And I think almost seeing someone struggle for him feeds that powerful ego that he wants. Like, I'm so powerful that people, like, someone would die for me. Like, someone like Feyre would die for me, you know? So I feel like Feyre was 100% way more committed than Tamlin by the end. And I was just, like, I wasn't pleased. I was like, okay, this can't just, like, be the end of it, you know?
You're right. Like, Feyre at the very end is far more committed to Tamlin. You know, in the podcast, we talk about that being more of a survival tactic on her part. Mm-hmm. But it was always just the, what you gonna do, Tamlin? What you gonna do? Let's, like, we're ready for it. And it's almost like when you're waiting for the beat to drop and nothing happens. It's so anticlimactic in the middle of the climax of the book.
Yeah, it was really disappointing, actually. I was like, this is where he's gonna shine through. Like, we're gonna see so much more of him and how powerful he is. And then it just didn't.
Yeah.
And I think I was sad for Feyre, right? Like, because I was like, she deserves more. She's doing all this stuff for Tamlin. But I'm not even seeing him doing anything. Like, if anything, Rhysand was more involved with her.
You know, I feel like this is a writing technique that Sarah J. Maas employs without having read the Throne of Glass series, but at least it's a pattern here in the A Court of Thorns and Roses series, that at the end of A Court of Mist and Fury and A Court of Thorns and Roses, you have resolution without having resolution.
Yes, that's accurate.
And it strings you along that you're like, no matter what, no matter how I feel about this, I have to find out what happens next.
That's a great point. Because like I said, I was kind of like, with all the references to other stories, I was a little bit underwhelmed with ACOTAR, like, right at the end. But because I was like, this can't be it with Tamlin. Like, this cannot just be how it ends. And there has to be more to their relationship, even if she is a Fae now and, you know, things with Aramantha are fixed for the time being. Like, I did keep reading because I was like, there has to be something else. And there was. So
a lot of other stuff to after that.
Thinking about the ending and how you're like, there's got to be more. Where do you feel like Feyre lies mentally and or emotionally at the end of the book, knowing that she's been on this journey this entire time, trying to find a balance or figure out the difference between surviving and thriving?
You know, she has the period where she's in the Spring Court and she's able to just kind of rest for a little bit. But survival is still deeply ingrained in her. And we see that right at the end. Like, she's still doing anything she can to survive. And I don't think she's at a point where she can start to thrive. I don't think she knows what that means yet. Because even when she was with Tamlin in the Spring Court, like, she wasn't thriving. It was kind of the illusion, like, of I'm thriving, because there was no difficulty in the sense that she wasn't having to hunt or anything like that. And Tamlin was protecting her in a way. But she wasn't in, like, a thriving relationship, I would say. Like, when we're talking about the cycles of abuse, like we mentioned earlier, like, she's clearly, like, dealing with emotional abuse. And I really don't think you can thrive while in that kind of relationship.
That's an interesting point. And it goes back to something you said earlier in the interview, this illusion of freedom and how painting is an illusion of freedom. After these events, she's not capable of painting for a very long time. Mm-hmm. She's not capable of seeing art because I think that illusion has been shattered. And so, to your point, I think she comes to a realization she doesn't know what it means to thrive. She thought she did, but now she's realizing that that was a facade. And this book is ending with she's kind of back at square one.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of thriving, you know, is experiencing difficulty, but being supported and coming out on top at the end, or even not, right? You don't have to always come out on top to be thriving, but just having the support system to help you through that. And I really don't think Tamlin is the support system who would be there for her if she had failed.
Not at all. I mean, if you think about it, the second book starts with her failing. And again, I don't believe she's actually failing, but to move forward, right? Because Tamlin is like, okay, we're pushing ahead. Life is normal. And she's not able to put that same facade as he is, because of course he's not coping either. But I think he holds it against her.
And I would say that I think you're right, Amy, about this image being shattered, because we pick up patterns in our family life. Like, we assume roles to help us survive through trauma. And so with her family in the human world, like, her role was, I'm the one who's hunting. I'm the one taking care of my family. And so when she goes to Tamlin, that role is still deeply ingrained in her. And she's still like, I need to provide something in order to survive in this environment. And now that that illusion has been shattered, I think it shatters her role for herself too. Like, I can't provide anything in this way. I can't give him what he wants, which threatens my survival.
This is another season two spoiler, but going back to this idea of the facade, Tamlin puts the facade back on where Feyre realizes that's impossible. And we see that in season two, or in A Court of Mist and Fury, with him replacing the front doors to the manor. And we remember how the front doors being smashed is the closing or the ending of a chapter in Feyre's life. He puts those doors back and she specifically calls them out. And I think that's in a really important moment for Feyre, recognizing that Tamlin is trying to do something she's no longer capable of doing.
Very important question to ask you, Hannah.
Okay, I'm ready.
What was worse, Tamlin forcing Feyre to drop her emotional support cookie, or Tamlin biting her neck while during that spicy scene in the hallway after Calamai?
The emotional support cookie.
Thank you.
And I say that just because if someone made me let go of some food I was eating.
Right?
For any reason, but especially when I'm emotional. How dare you?
It's cruel. It's not okay. And talk about food as power.
It's so symbolic. This is the symbol for me.
Okay. So before we wrap up, what are you excited for us to cover in A Court of Mist and Fury?
I'm just excited for all the Rhysand stuff. I love this man. Mm-hmm. I would die for this man. And so I'm really interested to kind of hear you analyze his character. Because I think I recognize he has weaknesses, but I like him so much that I'm like, it's okay. Everyone has weaknesses, you know? But I felt that way about Tamlin in the first book. And so now I'm concerned. So I'm just excited to hear everything you guys have to say about that and about his relationship with Feyre and how that dynamic is different than her relationship with Tamlin.
Yay.
Or is it?
I know.
Dun, dun,
dun. No. Dun, dun, dun. Oh, no. No. To be continued.
Y'all.
Summer 2022.
Well, thank you again, Hannah, so much for being on the podcast with us. Yes,
thank you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I think you brought some really great insights, and I think your studies to become a therapist are actually really enlightening for this whole conversation.
Well, thank you. I'm sad, though, that we didn't get a single Taylor Swift reference in, because I know y'all do that a lot.
I try to work it in. Okay, here we go. You could say that their relationship was sad, beautiful, and tragic.
Tragic. Yes.
Hannah, can you tell the listeners where they can find you?
You can find me on YouTube at Hannah Chung or on TikTok and Instagram at Hannah L. Chung. And last name is spelled C-H-E-U-N-G.
Thank you for listening to this special episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform.
As we gear up for season 2, where we will deep dive into A Court of Mist and Fury, we will continue to share between season thoughts and interviews with our listeners.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a weekly mini episode.
If you are enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo. Or find us on TikTok and Instagram at the handle Book Talk for Book Talk.